68 degrees, Kenosha and Racine, 61 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu.
We begin today's morning show here on WGTD by finishing up the interview begun yesterday with former Racinian David Rozelle, who spent most of his childhood growing up in an orphanage on the south side of Racine, which no longer exists, but which is, of course, potently remembered by all those who lived there. The book is called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree, Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. In this beautifully written memoir, David Rozelle remembers quite fondly his experience of growing up in the Taylor Children's Asylum, as it was officially known. And say a word about dinner at Taylor Home, because you spell out some of the etiquette that was very important in the way that meals were served, and clearly you think some important lessons were learned in these moments.
This is true. The dining room consisted of a number of dining tables, and we were all assigned to a table with a matron who would then sit on one end and sort of quarterback our food and our eating of the food. Yes, we were required to sit up straight. We were required to use our napkins. We were required to eat our food with the right utensils. We were encouraged to say to say things like "please pass the potatoes," or not act up at the table. To, as I recall, respect everybody's presence at that table, especially of course the matron. And then we had to sit at the table until the meal was done. As I recall, it was after I'd gathered the dirty dishes, and then we might say something like "May we be excused." And we were excused and went back to whatever awaited us after the meal. The food was, as I recall, excellent given the time. Remember, this was World War II, and there was rationing. And then after the war, there were shortages as well. But the food was excellent. And I should tell you that one of the people who came back into my life after the writing of the book had been a girl who lived there. And she told me her fondest memory of the home was the smell of breakfast. Can you imagine that?
Mm.
This was a children's home, an orphanage, and her fondest memory was the beautiful smell of breakfast. So the dining room was quite important in our lives. There was, I point out in the book, a mural, I don't know who did it, on one of the walls, and that also has stuck in my memory, and I wonder what happened to it when the home was demolished. I wish I had even a copy of it.
Mm. A quick word about life outside the home. You write in one chapter about how, unfortunately, you experienced what a lot of orphans do, namely a stigma attached to, so-and-so is from the orphanage, and that depending on where you were, for instance, and what school you were in, the fact that you lived in an orphanage attached to you a certain stigma that could be very, very difficult to shake. And that for you, one of the best things that ever happened through the course of your childhood was when you changed schools, and the people at your new school, the teachers and your peers, seemed to not have any idea at all that you lived at the Taylor Orphanage. And that made all the difference in the world.
Yes, I thought about that a lot since that time in my life. I did feel stigmatized when, let's say, the children in the classroom knew I was an orphan. And perhaps a lot of that feeling came from within me. I might have been perceiving something that wasn't quite as strong. But I think it was there. We were kids from the home. So, and it was obvious in how we dressed. Our clothing was clean, but I have a picture of myself sitting on the rim of the sandbox at the home, in which it's obvious the pants I'm wearing have been let down maybe once or twice. So, yes, I felt the stigma. But then, for perhaps two months in my life, I lived with my grandmother and went to another school where everyone assumed I had a life just like theirs, because I was coming from my grandmother and her second husband's house, and they were middle-class, hardworking people, and I would bolt out the door and head for the school. Suddenly, I was being asked to read to the class. In other words, I was chosen to be a reader. I was called on in class. I felt comfortable, I think, raising my hand for once. And during the play periods, I found myself sort of a playground leader. Those things had never happened to me before. And I love this new disguise, if you will, because I did not feel stigmatized. As I point out in the book, I think stigma is a noxious weed. And I felt that noxiousness for a time, and it affected my self-esteem. But once I got into a place where, a school where no one knew where I came from, no one knew the truth about me, I felt like a new person, and I was amazed.
At any rate, what occurred within the walls of Taylor Home was, for you, tremendously positive. And I love this paragraph from early in the book when you write, "During my time there, the home thrived in the hands of good-hearted women, some of advanced, some of middling, some of ordinary education. What does it matter? What matters is that during every moment of my life with them, they held that I, like all children, was a human being in the making." I mean, that really says a lot. Because we imagine a whole lot of institutions not being guided by as essential a principle as that. Fortunately for you and your peers, Taylor Home was a place where the people who worked there, by and large, cared about you to that profound an extent.
Yes, that's true. And I must tell you, when I wrote the book, I thought perhaps I was looking back at that time in my life at Taylor Home with rose-colored glasses. I thought I was recalling something that was not as sweet as I remembered it. But in writing the book and doing a couple of presentations and having some of my, let's call them brothers from the home, return after that long, long period of time, and then talking to them, they all said the same thing. This was the best period of our life. Let me tell you a story about one of them. This kid, whose last name I remember, but he's changed his name since then because of family reasons. He was prouder of his mother than he was of his father. At any rate, this fellow was placed in a foster home, and I don't understand why, except that apparently they thought he was ready to be placed in a foster home. So he was placed in a home. And it was miles away from Taylor Home, and he realized that this foster home was not a good place for him. It was not good. So on a February night, a cold February night, he ran away from that home, and you might imagine where he was headed. He wanted to get back to Taylor Home, and it was miles away, and it was cold. His clothing was inadequate. I'm sure he ran out in maybe a T-shirt and tennis shoes. And he didn't make it. He collapsed on the way back to Taylor Home. And he told me his last memory of that runaway were the site of the red lights. So he ended up in a hospital. He had a very bad case of pneumonia. And the physicians said to his mother, who was a working woman trying to provide support for her children, but unable to work and take care of them, so she had placed them in the home. His mother greeted the physician, who told her, look, this boy needs to be in a warmer climate, or he's in for more trouble. So guess what she did? This is an amazing story, and it's true. A month later or so, she and her son and her daughter ended up in Hawaii. Can you believe it? At Pearl Harbor, where she had a job with the Navy as probably a receptionist, a stenographer or something. So suddenly this guy, who had nearly died of the cold in Wisconsin, finds himself walking barefoot in Hawaii. Well, she was laid off at Pearl. But the Navy liked her work and said to her, well, where would you like to live? We have naval bases all over the place. And she decided on San Diego. So the family ended up in San Diego, all right? So this fellow grows up then in San Diego, goes to San Diego State, gets a master's degree in, guess what, philosophy and social work, returns to Wisconsin, and becomes a prominent social worker here who specializes in the treatment of children. Now, that's a true story.
Wow.
I've met this guy. I've seen pictures. And yeah, fantastic story.
One striking thing you say is that the interest that the folks there at Taylor Home had in you extended even after you had left. I think you give a couple of different examples of the way in which this played out very tangibly. I mean, you can actually open up a file and you have proof that they were concerned about you even when you were not even physically present there. Tell our listeners about that. I think it really speaks volumes about Taylor Home.
Well, I think you might be referring to a time when my real mother took my sister and me to live with her in Milwaukee. And we lived in a basement one-room apartment, and she worked as a waitress. And somehow she had cut her hand while waitressing, and the hand became infected. But at the same time, she became more severely mentally ill. So she couldn't tolerate being alone. So guess who became her companion? My sister and me. And that doesn't sound so bad, except that we weren't going to school. We were just walking around the streets of Milwaukee for, I'm not sure of the time, but eventually we were pulled out of school by her. And we just walked the streets with her because she couldn't tolerate being alone. At any rate, during that period, I have a letter from Taylor Children's Home to the Milwaukee Children's Society, asking them if they'd heard, that is the society, had heard anything about the Roselle children. They said, we have heard that they are experiencing some hard times. So there's Taylor Home inquiring about us, and they had no reason to do that except that they were concerned about us. They had those big hearts that somebody described these women as having. Well, at any rate, Children's Society looks into our predicaments, and guess what? I was returned to the home, and then so was my sister, who was later placed in a foster home, and they had saved us from really a thoroughly demoralizing situation, and one in which who knows what would have happened, because my mother then was placed into a mental hospital. I'm not sure. So that's one example. But a happier example was this. Once while looking through the files at home, I found a newspaper clipping from the Racine Journal. It was a picture of me with, a short caption that read, Roselle named editor of college newspaper. Now, I had been named, I think it was sports editor of the college newspaper, and like all colleges, my college, Whitewater, had sent out a press release. The journal had picked it up and ran it in their newspaper. Okay, so what? Except that someone at the home had seen that picture of me, clipped it, and put it in my file. So there was some pride then in our lives after the home by those who had taken care of us at the home. And somebody bothered actually to pull out a scissors, cut that photograph out of the picture and the caption, and put it in my file. So you asked me to tell a few instances of the home showing how much they cared for children after they'd left. These are two, I think, very good ones.
And it's probably important to also say that this is at a time when you didn't just go to the internet and Google somebody, or nowadays it seems like just about anything is possible to do. This is back in the day when one actually had to take out stationery and dictate a letter and put it in an envelope and affix a stamp and so on. I mean, it is
true.
That's the era that we're talking about, and it really took effort to make contact, to maintain contact, to follow up on a child like yourself. I mean, it speaks volumes about how much they cared about you and the other children at Taylor Home.
But it does indeed, and it's one of the reasons why I'd like the home memorialized in not just the book, but perhaps a little monument.
Mm. You ultimately, of course, as I already mentioned briefly, left Taylor Home on your way to foster care. It from the way you describe this was, in a sense, not their idea. It's, Taylor Home was not anxious to send you out the door, but it was sort of the expectation by the powers that be that an orphanage like Taylor Home would only house someone like yourself up to a certain age. Can you explain just what was going on there?
Well, I think what was going on was this. We're talking about, let's say, the late 1940s and early 50s, and I believe the nation and the state was going toward foster care as the sort of care to give children instead of institutional care. Now, when I'm cynical, I say that was, to some extent, all about money, because it was less expensive to place a child in foster care than it was to maintain them in an institution. The other thing is that I'm sure the powers that be were putting pressure on these institutions to place children in foster care. The foster care system we have now is one that fosters children, and children who are maybe troubled are the ones who end up in institutional settings. But as you've gathered, during my time, children of all predicaments and behaviors were placed in children's homes. There was a home in Sparta, for instance, sponsored by the state of Wisconsin. And we subscribed to the stigma. We'd heard about Sparta, and we imagined it was a typical children's home, I think. And a few of our mates were placed there. But during one of my book presentations, there was a guy there, an older guy, who was attending. This was in Union Grove, who raised his hand, and he said, "I want to tell you that I spent time at Sparta, and I love the life. It was far better than the life I had at home." So I don't recall if he ended up in foster care, but I suspect he did, as I did, as my sister did, and so many of us did. My experience in the foster home, comparatively speaking, was good. But we've all heard the tales of awful foster care placements and the troubles that some children have in foster care. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be foster care, but if I had a choice, based on my experience, between life in an institution like Taylor Children's Home and life in a foster home, there's no question, again, based on my experience, that I would choose Taylor Children's Home if I could find it again.
Hmm. If there were more such homes that existed.
Mm-hmm.
In our closing minute, let's hear from you on the really interesting life that you have led since Taylor Holmes, since the events chronicled in your wonderful memoir, just give our listeners a sense of what you have gone on to do, the really interesting, fulfilling life which you have enjoyed, and what you think Taylor Holmes had to do with that.
Yes, I suppose by most measurements, I've had a not only an interesting life, but a prosperous and successful one. After 6 years in the foster home, I graduating from high school, where I have wonderful teachers, by the way, and they made a big difference, too. Many of them World War II vets, and they were just eager to teach, and they'd seen the world, and it was a good experience for me. In one case, I was in touch with one of my teachers until the day he died just a few years ago. At any rate, on I went to Wisconsin State College Whitewater. And in those days, as I put it, the gates were wide open because tuition was so inexpensive. One rented his books at, no, one didn't have to rent the book. Yes, we did. Sorry. Yes, we didn't have to buy textbooks. They were rented to us. So expenses were minimal. No one had an excuse for not going to college if one chose to do that, because I worked in a factory during the summers, and my first year made enough money in just one summer to finance my first year of college. After that first year, when I've developed some habits that cost me a little more money, I got a job at a restaurant as a dishwasher. Of course, I was an experienced one, thanks to Taylor Children's Home. So I was able to finance my own education. I graduated virtually without debt and went on to teach in public high school for a while, working on my master's degree, by the way. When I achieved my master's degree, I joined the University of Wisconsin system as a teacher at one of the UW campuses. There, I won a Fulbright, of all things, to Denmark, and I spent a year in Denmark teaching American literature to Danish students. All right, I came back after that year in Denmark to complete my obligation to the university to spend another year there, and I decided I wanted to try a different way of life. I taught for a while, and I had the strong inclination to get out there into the real world and mix it up with so-called real people beyond the ivory tower. So I became the assistant director of a large rural community services program in Wisconsin. These organizations dealt with primarily people impoverished, and I felt I knew enough about that to be a pretty decent carrier of whatever help I could provide through the agency. At any rate, I worked there for a number of years and then jumped to a large mental health, a public mental health institution, where I became the community services director. I liked that because I also knew something about mental illness. I still had a sense of mission. I'm sure my many senses of mission came from my time at the Taylor Home. And I worked there, and that was really a gratifying job as well. Afterward, my wife was ready to go back to school, to college, completed her undergraduate degree, and we moved from a rural setting to Madison, Wisconsin, where she worked on her master's degree while I tried a life as a freelance writer. And to my amazement, I made a pretty good living in Madison doing freelance writing. Now we've moved back to the country. We live in a beautiful setting near Spring Green, a rural setting, by the way. And I'm retired and living the good life, and that also gave me the time to write this recollection of those miraculous years at Taylor Children's Home.
Hmm. If one drives past where it used to be, what does one see? I mean, what remains of what you describe in your book?
Well, the home was razed, bulldozed, so you won't see the home. You will see some buildings, little buildings by comparison, on the left of the property, which were used for a time as cottages for troubled children, and they're a modern variety of institutional care. They don't look very large. You'll see that those buildings are now used by is it the Village of Elmwood Park? as their, I guess, as their town hall, so to speak, as well as they have a gymnasium there and a few other things. So you won't see much. But if you get out of the car and walk around and look particularly at the trees, there's a large oak tree there with a plaque on it. And the plaque commemorates Taylor Children's Home and cites my memoir as a sort of stimulus for renewing interest in the home. So we spoke early. We're coming full circle here about Leah, my friend at college, and Rose. They actually made a trip to the Tarzan tree to see this plaque, and they sent me some pictures. And they should have been kids at the home. They look at my age like children as they, in my mind at least, play around the tree. So there's nothing there that would tell anyone that this huge institution had been there. And that's one of the reasons why there is this effort to erect a memorial.
Well, we can read more about the so-called clandestine society of the Tarzan tree and your exploits on the basketball court with your union suit showing the Christian education group that you signed up to attend because of the Clark chocolate bars that were offered and much, much more in this wonderful memoir, which again is called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree, Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. The book, by the way, is beautifully illustrated and published by Little Creek Press and the author, David Rozelle. David Rozelle, I have thoroughly enjoyed your memoir and this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much for telling this important story and for telling it so well and for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Well, thanks very much, and you are a truly wonderful interviewer. Leo was right. You're super duper. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Most of us, at least to some extent, know something of the tremendous harm that can be done by sexual abuse of children. And of course, many of us have read accounts of the way in which this has sometimes been done within organizations that on the surface were there to serve children, to enrich their lives. And indeed, such an organization might do that in every respect, but might have within its ranks an employee or volunteer who preys upon vulnerable children within that environment, and in doing so causes untold damage and harm. And perhaps someone even listening has been has suffered direct impact from that sort of thing. I'm very, very pleased to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Norman Bates, who is president and founder of Liability Consultants. This is a firm which seeks to work with organizations on this very, very difficult issue. And he was formerly an assistant professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University in Boston and director of security and legal counsel to the Saunders Hotel Corporations. So he has worked for decades now on various issues related to security and the law. But in his work with Liability Consultants, he is exploring some very, very important ground when it comes to this particular matter. And in fact, we'll be referring from time to time to a new publication called Preventing Child Sexual Abuse in Youth-Serving Organizations. Norman Bates, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Your booklet begins with a section titled The Scope of the Problem. And I think even for those of us who remember reading about this in the news, most of us, probably be shocked to know, in fact, just how widespread this problem, in fact, is. Give our listeners some sense of it.
Well, I guess I should start first by saying that we don't know how extensive it is, because one of the underlying problems is that so many of these cases are not reported. for a variety of reasons, whether it's the parents don't want to put the child through it, or the child, the victim, is reluctant to come forward. It's not unusual, for example, for someone to come forward 10 years later and talk about a situation they have experienced. But we've looked at various data sources from CDC and Department of Justice and so forth, and you know, they're talking about a range of anywhere from 8 to 20% of the child population under 18 has been subject to some kind of sexual abuse. And when we use the word abuse, so everybody's clear, it's not just the sexual assault per se, but it's also subjecting the child to inappropriate sexual conduct, behavior, exposing them to pornography, and so forth. So it takes it covers a wide range of issues.
I think a really interesting moment point in the booklet, in the publication, is a section titled "Interpreting the Data," in which you help us understand that, first of all, as you just said, in some cases we have no data. That is, many of these cases go completely unreported. But even when we are talking about those instances which are reported, in which there is sort of a paper trail, or it registers as data, there are all kinds of complications which make it very difficult to properly interpret the data. We probably don't need to know about every single facet of that difficulty, but maybe share one or two of the most significant sources of sort of complexity when we're talking about this.
Well, there isn't really one single source that this stuff is being reported to. You know, what happens is parents may discover their child is a victim and report to the local police, or they may report it to a state agency. There isn't a mechanism in place now, for example, where the FBI or some national agency would automatically get this information. So depending upon what source you look at, you get varying accounts of how broad the problem is overall.
Hmm. At one point, you talk about something I actually had not ever heard of, the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. This was really disturbing to read about. It helps us understand why so many children make the choice to not disclose what has been done to them. Explain what this child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome is.
Are we being taped right now?
Yes.
Good. Because where are you at in the publication? You're the first ones to ask me this question. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's towards the very beginning. It's in the thing called the scope of the problem, and it lists five different things that are. It's kind of in a gray sidebar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm trying to think who the reasons. These are the reasons why kids will not report. So, if you want to ask me the question,
the most disturbing items in this publication is when you spell out the facets of something that someone has called the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, which evidently helps us understand why so many children would choose not to disclose what has been done to them. Could you just talk a moment about this?
Sure. I think it's a combination of factors. The syndrome, if you will, and I'm using that term loosely, is it's this organization that came up with this child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. The one of the elements is the secrecy involved with the actual incident or activity that often takes place in some place where the child is alone with the individual and has no ability to call out for help. It could be in a bathroom someplace, for example, or in a car when they're being driven home or driven someplace else. Obviously, a child is pretty helpless because of their age and the dynamic of the age difference and the power that the adult has over that child as well. And then the child feels trapped, or they call it entrapment or accommodation. They feel trapped because they are not able to deal with this right away, and they're afraid. I mean, you think about a situation. It could be your scoutmaster or the guy who's teaching you karate lessons on the weekends, and you have that whole dynamic of that relationship between the adult and the child. And then, again, as I had mentioned before briefly, this, you know, the delay in reporting and then the fact that you've got a child who people question whether or not they're telling the truth or have they just made this up. They're not believed. From a prosecutorial standpoint, it's a real problem when you have, say a child victim who's 6, 7 years old, and the DA's office is looking whether or not they want to prosecute the case, and they know that this child is not going to do very well in a witness stand, and having to subject them to it in the first place, of course, is why a lot of parents don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And then the final part is it's not unusual for the child to retract his or her story and, you know, to, you know, say basically that, well, maybe this didn't happen or misunderstood what he did or something along that line. So it's what's really so upsetting about all this is these predators are taking advantage of all these different dynamics and so often are gone without being prosecuted.
Mm. One of the things your publication describes is a process that at first I didn't quite understand, and now as I read, I understand perfectly the process of grooming. Mm. Grooming, in this case, the term meaning the process by which offenders make their initial contact with a potential or intended victim and, in a sense, groom them in order to make then that abuse more possible.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not unusual for an offender to be grooming several children simultaneously in order to seek out the one who will be vulnerable and will allow him to commit his act. So that, yeah, there are different things. So it starts off, having a nice relationship. That there may be a little bit of touching, the pat in the back, which goes to the pat in the butt, and so forth, and escalates. But other types of grooming activities, seeking the child outside the organization, giving them a ride home. If you think about the kinds of stuff that Jerry Sandusky at Penn State did, it was a perfect example of how he set up a nonprofit organization to help kids, use the athletic facilities at Penn State to carry out his activity, and over a period of time would actually, develop a relationship to the point where the child now is feeling helpless and, is coerced into engaging in the activity.
Part of the whole point of your book is to think about this really awful phenomenon within the context of a youth-serving organization, something in which a parent brings their child and drops them off and assumes that they are going to be well taken care of and enjoy the benefits of whatever that organization happens to be, whether it's a sports team or a music conservatory or a Future Farmers of America or whatever we're talking about. I wonder if you could just talk about the significance of that when we are talking about an organization which apparently has the well-being of children in mind, to what extent does that cause parents to have their guard down or for children to walk in even more trusting than they would otherwise be? I mean, how significant a difference does that in fact make?
Well, I think you're really hitting the nail on the head, so to speak. That these people, these predators, are obviously drawn to these organizations because that's where the kids are, and that's where the opportunity to commit the crime exists. But as a parent, and I'm a parent, certainly my kids are grown now, but they went to summer camp programs and other after school programs and sports programs, and you'd like to think that they would be pretty safe in that environment. Is people who were, and the vast majority of people who work in these places, by the way, are very dedicated and care very much about these kids. It's just that predator is taking advantage of the environment where he has access to these children of various ages. But yeah, we would expect that they would be safe, and most of the time they are. But the exposure is there, and unfortunately, we see varied results in terms of what organizations do, how well they do it, in terms of screening their staff and their volunteers and how they supervise everybody.
It seems that you are speaking from two different points of concern here, and I want to, before we run out of time, give you a chance to kind of address both. Some of what is in this publication is very much directed to parents and designed to help parents, first of all, make wise decisions when it comes to choosing to whom to entrust their children, even for, you know, limited amounts of time, and what a parent should do if their child comes to them with a revelation as awful as this. Let's begin with the first thing, the matter of choosing wisely. What is your advice for parents?
Well, and this was really part of the purpose of the publication, to target parents in addition to the organizations and providing them some guidance. But for parents, you know, really, if you're going to send your, the example I use all the time, you're going to send your child to summer camp for a couple of weeks. Before you do that, you know, talk to the people who administer the program and find out how they screen their employees and their volunteers, because that's just as important. It's not just the paid staff, and what kind of criminal history checks they do and interviews and so forth and background you know, references and so on. A lot of people don't understand or don't realize that there is no national database that most organizations have access to for criminal histories, conviction histories. Usually it's a state-by-state system and with some limited exceptions. There are questions that also need to be asked about what the organization has for policies and procedures with respect to having a child be alone, one-on-one with an adult. That should not be allowed, you know, regardless of what the age is. So there are just all these different considerations that we talk about in the publication, and that parents need to really, you know, do their own interview, their own due diligence, if you will, before the child gets sent off for a couple of weeks.
Hmm. What about when the child comes to you with a revelation that perhaps something has happened? I think your publication gives a number of different helpful suggestions. Why don't you highlight one or two?
Well, I think what even before you get to that point, one thing I don't want to miss out on mentioning is the importance of talking to your child before they go off to a program and talking about these issues, as uncomfortable as they may be, but to have discussion with the child so that the child is aware that certain types of behaviors, you know, like touching, is not appropriate and should be reported. If the child comes to you and reports that, depending upon what state or jurisdiction you're in, you need to find out what organization would best be able to handle it, the investigation, that is. And a lot of times, you know, a small-town police department, for example, would not have a person on staff who had been trained on how to investigate these incidents. You know, you'd have to look most likely state level, different state agencies that exist that where someone has been trained properly to investigate, and of course reporting it right away to the organization as well is critical so that they can do at least some of their own preliminary investigation. Again, not that they're skilled on a law enforcement level, but you know, you don't want this person abusing somebody else because you waited to report it.
What about organizations themselves? This is obviously tremendous importance that organizations that serve young people do a better job of screening their employees, looking for potential abusers in their ranks. They just need to be awake to this possibility. What would be one or two of the most important ways in which an organization could, in a sense, police itself, safeguard itself against such an awful thing occurring?
Well, I think that the background check is certainly the important thing. And a background check doesn't mean just criminal history. It means, you know, doing the personal and professional references and interviews and verifying a person's qualifications, if they have to have a certain educational background or a certificate that's all verified. And for the organization to certainly be, you know, aware of the importance of documenting all that they've done. We've done a number of cases involving these very issues. So They need to understand the legal implications. If you hire someone without a proper background check and it turns out they have a history of something that, some behavior that should have precluded them, there could be some very significant liability. And we're talking, not talking about $100,000, we're talking about millions of dollars of potential liability. Plus, you know, the other sort of non-insured risk, if you will, is that organization is going to be damaged severely in the public eye and could cause, long and short, it could cause a business to close down if it's that, you know, bad of a situation. So they've got to be hyper aware, and certainly while we consult with these types of groups, they need to be talking to their own legal counsel to understand what the legal issues are and what their rights and obligations are to do background checks and comply with the EEOC or Equal Employment Opportunity Commission guidelines as well. So.
If people want more information about this, about liability consultants, or would like to secure access to this publication, Preventing Child Sexual Abuse in Youth-Serving Organizations, what should they do?
We actually have a link on our website. The company is Liability Consultants, and our website is liabilityconsultants.com. If you go to that website, then we have a button there for publications. Click on that, and then there's a PayPal connection there, so they can, you know, purchase the book. It's I think it's $25 plus tax. So.
The publication, again, is Preventing Child Sexual Abuse in Youth-Serving Organizations, and one of its authors, Norman Bates. Norman Bates, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I trust that this has been a potentially helpful, maybe even life-saving interview, and I wish you well with the good work that you and your organization are doing.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate that.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am delighted to welcome back into our studios John Hembrock, who is responsible for a very popular comic strip called The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, which is syndicated to newspapers across the country. We'll catch up with John Hembrock on tomorrow's Morning Show. On Friday, best-selling author Earl Swift talking about his latest book, which is called Autobiography, in which, in remarkable fashion, he traces the complete legacy of ownership of a particular 1957 Chevy station wagon. 13 different owners dating back to when that car was first purchased new back in 1957. And the intriguing stories of each and every owner through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s to the present day. A really remarkable book. We'll talk with him on Friday. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for sunshine in the morning, partly cloudy skies over the afternoon with a very slight chance of afternoon rain, a high of 79 degrees. Tonight, actually, a cloudy sky and an 80% chance of rain and thunderstorms, low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy with a 50-50 chance of rain, a high of 73 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Right now, for the most part, sunny skies promised for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Rain resuming Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.